It's recording.
So at this time,
started.
I would like to turn over the microphone to Peggy Greenwell with the U.S. Access Board. She will introduce our presenters today and introduce the session. Peggy, the microphone is yours.
Thanks, Robin, and welcome everyone to our session today on accessible retail stores and spaces. This is an advanced session. We offered a webinar on this session previously. Our intent here is to try to have a more advanced level discussion about retail stores and spaces. And today we are joined by two veteran accessibility specialists at the board. Both have been here over 20 years. Paul Beatty is, again, been here over 20 years and is currently working on the passenger vessel rulemaking as well as the rail rulemaking. Earlene Sesker is, again, been here over 20 years, and she's working on, in addition to being an accessibility specialist, she's working on the medical diagnostic.
Conference recording stopped.
So at this point, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Earlene.
Good afternoon, everyone. And again, thank you for joining us. We have identified, Paul Beatty and I will actually be speaking with you today about your retail store spaces. And in our quest to ensure that you have accessible retail spaces and stores, we identified three major areas that we thought would be best to discuss with you today. One would be the alterations, and you may look at that and say, well, why are they starting with alterations? And one of the reasons being with that is because the new construction requirements are more clean cut. When you deal with the alterations, although we are aware that there are probably multiple sales establishments being constructed as we speak, but there's also the real problem that we get a lot of calls on, that you have existing retail facilities, things that possibly predated the act and now they're doing upgrades, they're doing renovations, they want to clean a newer look, and so they need to know what to do. Also, you have those that maybe were not constructed initially to be retail establishments, and so now they're changing those over. And when you look at your alterations provisions, they're a little less stringent than the new construction provisions, and so we thought it would be good to focus on that, to let you know with these existing facilities what type of things you need to be looking at. Then we're going to look at your exterior, and we're going to tell you with your exterior how to get to that retail establishment. We can give you everything that we need to today on how to make the retail establishment accessible on the interior, but you need to get there first. So we'd be looking at the exterior, and then we will also tell you about all of the interior requirements. What you'll find is a lot of the exterior and interior requirements are the same as you would see in any other facility, but there are, especially on the interior, things that are specific to your retail stores and spaces. And then, after we've done all of those discussions, we will have time for questions. I want to let you know that we do realize there were questions that were submitted, and our intent is to answer those questions that were previously submitted within our presentation today. But at the end, and you can submit questions while we're speaking to you, so if something in response to some of the questions you asked, it's not clear, maybe we've confused you even more, feel free to send a follow-up question, and at the end we will have time to address those questions. And if for any reason you feel like your question was not properly addressed, or you didn't get a chance to get that question addressed, feel free to send us a request at TA, and Paul or I will get back to you with a response. And with that said, we will start now with our alteration provisions. As I mentioned earlier, slide 13. You have to excuse me. I haven't done this in a while, so just bear with me. But slide 13, and now we're going to start on our alteration provisions. And it's important to note at the top of each of the slides, you will see that we have the sections for the ADA as well as the AVA provisions, although some of them may differ. But those that are the same, we will point out if there's a difference, we will also point that out. As I said, with new construction, it's more basic. And with new construction, the way the standards are written, we tell you everything needs to be accessible, of course, unless there's an exemption, your employee work area exemptions, and if something is partially scoped. But when you're looking at your alterations, things are based on a little tighter, bit tighter requirements. For one, when we look at your alterations, it's going to be according to your planned scope of work. Then you may have instances more so that you would see with alterations than any other time with technical infeasibility. And then we have if you're actually doing an alteration to the primary function area, because then there will be additional requirements in addition to that planned scope of work that we talked about initially. Slide 14. When you're looking at your alteration provisions, another big difference that you will see between your new construction and your alteration is when you have a new constructed facility and you have an required accessible element, we tell you that you need to have an accessible route to all accessible elements. When you're dealing with an altered space, and we talked about the scope of the work, what we look at with that is that you do not, say, for instance, you're doing an alteration to a bathroom, okay, and you're just going to be doing that to, say, the toilet in the bathroom. That would be the only thing, because then if that's what you're planning to do, you've touched it, that's the scope of your work, that would be what you would be required to make accessible. But unless you were planning to do an alteration to that circulation path that gets you there, there would be no requirement under the alterations that you do that unless that alteration that you were doing would be to a primary function area, and then you would have path of travel obligations. As I'd said, the toilet room would not be considered primary function area, but in the path of travel requirements, that toilet room could be netted up to be accessible, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later. But as I said, with alterations, we're looking at what you alter and that those standards apply to the actual element that you alter. Because you touch the toilet, you don't then have to make the entire toilet room accessible. Slide 15. This is just to let you know more of a functioning of the way the ADA standards are written now. In the previous standard, the way everything was set up is we had a separate section that just spoke to you about alteration provisions. What you'll see now, and I'm sure many of you or most of you are very familiar with using the new standard as it exists, but what you will see is that now the alterations are written as exceptions to the applicable provisions. But what is important to note is that if you have, say, your drinking fountain provisions and the scoping, if there's an exception to the amount of drinking fountains or the number of drinking fountains that are supposed to be accessible, then you're going to find that exception in the actual scoping provisions versus looking in the actual technical provisions. So just be aware that although the alteration provisions are now written as exceptions, and what we will refer to is it'll say if it's an alteration or if this is to an existing facility. But just remember when you're looking for a scoping exception or how something is treated in an alteration for scoping and as far as numbers, you would actually need to look in that scoping section for it. If you're looking for technically, if there's an exception, then you would again look in the technical provisions for that. Slide 16. Earlier I mentioned the three things that you're looking at with your alterations. One was the scope of work. The second one that I said we discuss is your technical infeasibility. And when you're dealing with technical infeasibility, you're dealing with things like you may have space limitations. You look at your existing physical site constraints. And this could be something as simple as you might need to enlarge a space. But in order to enlarge that space, the wall that would have to be moved is a load-bearing member for that wall. Those are the type of things that we consider technically infeasible when you're dealing with existing site constraints. Another thing would be if there is a conflict with a code, okay, and you see this a lot of times in your plumbing codes. If in order to get that accessible stall, you would need to decrease the number of fixtures, and your actual plumbing code says based on the occupancy in that building, you need this number of fixtures, then again, that is something that we would look at as technically infeasible. But what you must note is that when we say something is technically infeasible, that does not mean nothing has to be done. If it is found that based on the plumbing code or your existing site constraints, you cannot make whatever that element is fully accessible to the extent to meet everything within the actual technical specifications or the actual number specifications, what we'd be looking for is that you would do those alterations to the maximum extent feasible. And also know that when you're doing a small alteration, then you have a greater chance of running into something that may be technically infeasible. But if you're doing a massive alteration where you might be gutting out that entire facility, then what you're going to find is that it's less likely that you're going to run into technical infeasibility. Slide 17. When you're doing alterations to your path of travel, you're doing alterations to a primary function area. And I touched on that a little bit earlier also. We talked about whether it's the scope of the work, and then we talked about technical infeasibility. Now we're looking at your path of travel. What the path of travel says is that if you're doing an alteration to a primary function area of a facility, then you have to spend an additional up to 20% of what the cost of that alteration is to provide an accessible path of travel to that altered area. One very important thing to note is that 20% is only calculated on the actual cost of the alteration to the primary function area. So maybe outside of the primary function area, you're doing all types of alterations to this facility, but only a portion of that is for that primary function area. When you go to calculate that additional 20%, that should only be on that alteration to the primary function area. And you're not required to go beyond that 20%. But again, as with the maximum extent feasible, you are required to go up to that 20%. So you can't say, well, I couldn't make this facility completely accessible because the 20% wouldn't get me there. Then you do as much as you can with that 20%. Also, facilities can have more than one primary function area, and that's something to note. And when you're dealing with retail facilities, it can be something as simple as a lot of the grocery stores now have banks within them. So you could have people that are actually coming into that grocery store just to go to the bank. They're not coming to shop. So that banking area would be a primary function area just as well as the shopping area. So you can have a facility that has more than one primary function area. And now in addition to the primary function area, when we talk about that accessible path of travel, note that that means all of the elements that serve that particular primary function area. And that's going to include things like your restrooms, your phones, your drinking fountains. You need to be sure that that route gets you from your access points onto the site through your entrance and back there to that. Now, when we talk about different things, I'm going to digress just a tad here. When we talk about things like drinking fountains, and we talk about those as something that are on the primary function area, they serve the primary function, therefore they should be on the path of travel. We did get a question about drinking fountains because we had a very broad in our scoping, and we talk about all of the places where drinking fountains are required to be accessible. And in looking at that, it looks like that all of the spaces possible in a facility are netted up. So the question was, what else? What instances then wouldn't the drinking fountain have to be? And basically, we do have general exceptions within the requirements, and in those general exceptions areas, we do say not only are the rooms not required to be accessible, but you're not required to have an accessible route to those. So if for any reason you have a drinking fountain that's in one of those areas that have the general exception not required to be accessible, there wouldn't be a requirement for that drinking fountain in that space to be accessible. Now the only exception to that is when you would be talking about your employee work area, because with your employee work area, there is a requirement that you have an accessible route that's going to get you to that area. And any common use element that's within that area then would be required to be connected by an accessible route. Also, in looking at the things that actually serve and that are required to be accessible on your path of travel, it talks about phones, paid telephones. We all know that we probably don't see too many paid telephones anymore, maybe in airports. But we have another little caveat in our provisions that actually are even more extinct than when you do see a paid telephone, because we have something that actually talks about the directory for that paid telephone. You see the directories even less than you see the paid telephones, but the bottom line is we do have a provision that speaks to that. And what we say is that the directory needs to be located as per the requirements in Section 309. With that, the first thing that I want to say is that that would only be if that directory is actually connected. It would need to be mounted. We wouldn't be talking about a book that's just lying there. But in answer to the question, if you have that there and it is connected, what we're saying is it needs to be located. So that means that the provisions for the reach range that are mandated in Section 309.3, because we do refer you to 309, the operable parts, but only part 3.3 because of the fact that we say located as. Slide 18. Okay. This is actually a slide to give you a better example of what we're talking about when we talk about the path of travel. So when I talked about the access points to the site, it's showing you from, say, a bus stop. It's showing you the parking that's provided on the site. And as you can see, it's not giving you it's giving you accessible routes from each of these elements, but they do converge onto one larger accessible route. And that accessible route is taking you through the facility. It's showing the things that I talked about, serving the area, your toilet room, your telephones, and taking you back to that primary function area. Another thing that I think is important to note is that the primary function area on this drawing, it's a very simple one. It takes you straight through. You could have a facility and many retail facilities that are multiple levels. Okay? And this is going to be especially true if you have a facility that's doesn't meet the shopping mall, which may possibly get the exception, or you don't have that doctor's office, or it's nothing on that upper floor that you would need to get to. The path of travel, if you're doing an alteration to a path to a primary function area, that primary function area could be on an upper floor, which would then, in some cases, make you have to provide a path of travel for vertical exception. Now, this does not trump your vertical exception requirements for vertical exception with the elevator where we talk about. But say you have a facility that when you built it, maybe they qualified for the exception. As I said earlier, you could have a retail space that was not initially constructed to be a retail space. And now you're making it a retail space. Change of use doesn't now require you to do alterations, but in determining and in attempting to make that into a retail space, now maybe you're doing alterations, you're doing these alterations to a second floor, and now it's a retail space, which does not necessarily get the exception for the vertical access. So now there may be a requirement with the path of travel for you to provide vertical access. And remember, you would still just have that 20% disproportionate. So up to that 20%, you could be required to provide that vertical access unless the facility qualifies for one of the exceptions. Slide 19. Okay. Now we've concluded the alterations portion, and now we're going to talk about your accessible route, getting you from your vehicle, from your public bus stops, your sidewalks, getting you to the actual accessible entrance of your retail space. And with that, in sections 206, and this is the same for both the ADA and the ABA, there's a requirement that you have at least one accessible route, and that's going to connect you from your public streets and sidewalks, from your parking, all of your site arrival points, and all of your common use spaces on that site. All of these things need to be connected to your accessible entrance. And if you have a facility that has multiple tenancies, that is going to be an accessible route that's going to get you to each of those entrances for that multiple tenancy. Slide 20. Okay. Again, we are showing you here your site arrival points. This is a closer. We're not taking you all the way through as the other one did to your primary function area because now we're talking about just your accessible route requirements. And as you can see, the bus stop, the public parking, and all of these, and the public sidewalk. Now, a thing to note here is when we talk about that accessible route that's going to get you from the access points, if in this drawing or this diagram that you're seeing here, that bus stop looks like it may actually be on the property, within the property line of the facility, but in many urban areas and so forth, we are aware of the fact that you may have a bus stop that you have to cross a public sidewalk to actually gain access onto the site. Now, the requirement is not requiring that the facility owner provide an accessible route outside of the boundary of their property. So it would just be up to the boundary of your site, okay, that you would make these connections. Now, if at all possible, I wouldn't say, we wouldn't say that it could be a good idea. I mean, if you have a wonderful relationship with your local jurisdiction and you can actually talk to them and coordinate that, go for it. But it's not a requirement. And hopefully with the public rights of way guidelines that are coming up, maybe there will be more leverage to stand on to get that worked out for it to be from the public onto your site. Okay. And another thing to note is if you're in an area, say you have a retail store that does not provide any pedestrian means for someone to actually access other than the driveway, your vehicular way is your only way back to that particular facility. With that, the ADA standard is not requiring that you provide that accessible route if the vehicular way is the only way to actually access the facility. Slide 21. This slide here is in response to a question that we received ahead of time, and what they were looking at is to ask the question with brick pavers or stamped concrete if they can be used as part of the accessible route. The ADA standards does not specify surfaces. Our standards are basic, and we talk about firm, stable, and slip resistant. Pavers and stamped concrete, as long as you meet the requirements, our surface requirements, your opening requirements, your change of level requirements, as long as those are met, any surface basically can be used for your accessible route, as long as it meets the applicable requirements. Slide 22. Now we've gotten the accessible route from the sidewalks. One of the other points we had said that you would need, because the parking is also considered a site arrival point. And so when you're looking at your parking, if you look at this facility, it could be, I mean, this looks like one big facility, but when you see the multiple doors, this could be a facility with multiple tenant entrances. And your parking is there midway, according to what we're seeing. So now we're going to talk a little bit more about parking and your accessible route from your parking to your accessible entrance. 23. Okay. For your accessible parking scoping, first of all, we know that with the parking for all types of facilities, well, for your basic facilities, it gets a little different when you're talking about medical, but for your standard facilities, like a retail store, there is a chart in Section 208 and F208 that tells you based on how many parking spaces are available for the facility. It tells you how many of those need to be accessible parking spaces. But we also give an exception to that. So if you have an area that's only to be used for delivery trucks or a fleet of vehicles, we do say as long as those lots, if they have to be accessed by the public, you do need to provide a passenger loading zone. But if they're not to be accessed by the public and they're used exclusively for delivery and company fleet vehicles, you're not required to make those spaces accessible within that limit of what the chart would require. And additionally, if you have, and this is more of a note, when you're looking at disbursement, you're looking at, we talked about several tenancies. The last show, or the picture that you saw, it showed the parking looked like it was right in the middle of the building. But if you have multiple tenancies and limited space, we just want to ensure that you know that the shortest route possible to all accessible entrances, you could disperse that parking or spread that parking out so that you can have the shortest accessible route to each of the tenancies. 24. Okay, your accessible route must connect to the accessible aisle that's required for your parking spaces. As you're aware, vehicles, multiple vehicles can share one access aisle, but that access aisle has to connect to your accessible route. Be a part of that accessible route to get you from that vehicle parking space to the accessible entrance of the facility. Although we do not require that that access route be placed in front of the cars, we do recommend, if at all possible, that you prevent the travel behind cars. Another thing to mention is when you see your access aisle and it's leading up to an actual curb ramp, know that that curb ramp cannot protrude into that access aisle. The access aisle is required to be the full length of that parking space that it serves. Okay. And at the top, another thing to note, especially if you're in an urban area, you don't have a lot of space, with the new requirements in the ADA, we do require that there be 36 inches at the top of that ramp for someone to actually be able to turn and go into either direction. So usually you're not leading you right into the door. So you're going to need to actually maneuver. So what I would recommend is, in a situation where you don't have that 36, what you may want to do is do a parallel curb ramp where you're going to have that flat surface that you're coming in on the middle and you're ramping up on either side. That way you're still getting that accessible route, still a compliant curb, and nothing is in the access aisle. And you're providing that accessible route to allow someone from the parking to get to the entrance. 25. Okay. When you're looking at parking spaces, as I said, we have the chart, but there is an exception when you have a facility that has four or fewer spaces. What you need to know, we don't mean four or fewer accessible spaces. You'd be looking at every space that's available, including the accessible spaces. And if you have four of all of your spaces, then you're not required to have signage for those. One of the things that we get questions on that gets a little confusing for some is when we start talking about the accessible spaces, the required signs, and we say a sign is required. So we get questions a lot on, are we saying there needs to be an individual sign at the head of each of the parking spaces? Actually, in essence, we don't say that, but what we're saying is that it needs to be clearly designated. So there could be an instance, and I've seen it done, where you may have multiple parking spaces and they're all in a line. You have them all lined up. That's the closest on the closest accessible route to the accessible entrance. And you may want to put a sign on one end and a sign on the other end with the arrows pointing in to clearly show that all of the spaces in between there are accessible spaces. But in some way, it needs to be a clear indication that all of the signs are accessible. Excuse me, all of the spaces are accessible. 26. This is to show you what not to do. And you find this, actually we see this more the opposite. This picture is actually showing a garbage dispenser in the actual space. But what you see more is that it'll be in the access aisle so that the person that pulls up, they can park in the space, but they can't get out into the access aisle. As I said, the access aisle needs to be the full length. If you have anything blocking that aisle so that it's not the full length of the parking space that it's serving, then it's not in compliance. So this is definitely a parking no-no. Next. 27, sorry, I said next. Okay, now when we look at the accessible route, and before I go on, we're going to look at this picture, and it was brought to my attention that although we have the maneuvering clearance there for the person, the dog is almost being required to walk through the door because the dog would have to have space to come around. I'm not going to talk to you about the dog and the maneuvering space for the dog at this point, even though I know on this picture it doesn't look like we're being very kind to the animal. But what this is meant to show you is that there is maneuvering space requirements for the exterior of the door. So you're leaving your parking, you're leaving your public site arrival points, and you're following that accessible route. That accessible route to that entrance, there needs to be a landing that can accommodate the actual maneuvering clearance that's required for the operation of the doors at the entrance. 28. Entrances. And one of the things that I wanted to note with the entrances that some people miss is that in essence with the new 60% requirement, in an instance where in the older standard where you had maybe just two public entrances and we said 50%, only one of those would be required to be accessible. But now when we say 60%, we're saying that both of those, so if you just have the two public entrances, both of those are required to be accessible. And that is because, for instance, we have a provision now that tells you that if you have multiples and you have to do a calculation, you are now required per the ADA standards to round up to the next greatest whole number. So therefore, you've gone from possibly having two public entrances with only one being required to be accessible to having two public entrances and both being required to be accessible. And also, it's important to note that all of these other entrances, the entrance serving the direct access parking from any tunnels or one for each tenancy, these are in addition to the 60% if these entrances are public entrances. Okay, and remember that if you have a condition, you have a facility that maybe you haven't done any alterations and this facility was under the 50% and only one is required to be accessible, just ensure that that one is on the closest accessible route. Okay, and that if you are doing an alteration now and you were under where you only needed to have one, and if you're doing an alteration, you have one that's already accessible, and you're just doing an alteration, what the guidelines say or what the standard says now is that if you have one, it's already accessible, and it's on the shortest accessible route, and now you're doing an alteration to another entrance, you're not required to make that entrance accessible. Ensure that if you have multiple doors at an entrance, that at least one of those doors is fully compliant. And if you have a facility, as I said, that all of your entrances are not accessible, that there is a requirement that you designate which entrance is accessible using the International Symbol of Accessibility. 29. This is here because we still get many people, when they go to your retail establishments, they see the automatic door openers there. So in everybody's mind, it's there because it's a requirement. So then when they go to one that doesn't have the automatic door opener, we get a call, and I was at my local convenience store, my local grocery store, I want to file a complaint, they did not have the automatic door. And so we wanted to make it clear that although they're not required, we do recommend them in instances when it's possible. But automatic door openers are not a requirement. 30. I'm going to talk a little bit about your doors and gates now. These are, we talked about the entrance. We know that at least one of those doors need to be accessible. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, and this is came forth from a question, because as you can see, and as I mentioned, even with the platform going into the building, you need to have the appropriate maneuvering clearance. But there's a provision within the requirements that talk about that if you have things that are on either side of the door that actually make create an alcove situation, that you have to provide that forward approach. And we had a question asking how far away from the door then could things like shelves, mailboxes, planners, even ATM machines, how far away from the door they can they be so that it would no longer be considered a recess condition and you would not be required to have that forward approach. And basically what you would have to do is look at the approach that you would be making to that door and whether it's latch side, hinge side, push or pull. And the item in question would have to be far enough away from the door to meet the appropriate maneuvering clearance that's specified in Section 404. So if you're coming to that door from the latch side and it says that you need to have 42 inches away, that's how far away you would have to place whatever this item is. And you might see like your ATM machine, and while I'm talking about ATM machines, we did get a question about ATM machines, and there's a requirement that we talk about that if you have a clear or correct key, if you don't have a clear or correct key, then you need to have something that'll differentiate by sound or touch what the button is that you're about to push prior to activating it. Reason being for this, in that section 707.6.2, we actually give you an arrangement of keys, and we tell you that the keys need to be in ascending or descending, but we give you a choice, and they can either be ascending or descending. If you get ready to push, you may not know if you're pushing the 1 or if you're pushing the 7, because you're not sure whether they're ascending or descending on that machine. If there's a correct or clear key, when I push that 7 and I meant to push 1, it lets me know what I'm pushing then, because there are requirements for enunciation, for verbal cues to let you know what you're doing there. So when I find out that I pushed that, as long as I have something there that I can then correct or clear that, then I'm fine. But if I don't have a correct or clear button, then I need something or you need something on that machine to allow someone to know what they're about to push prior to activation. 31. Many retail stores that you go in, a lot of the bigger stores and so forth, you will see what we consider a doors in a series situation, where you would go in through the main door and then there's another set of doors that you would immediately have to open. That's what we call the doors in a series, and we say there should be a 48-inch minimum separation between the swing of the doors. Okay? In this situation, they're showing the one door swinging open, and you can see that the maneuvering space, the clear space for that person to enter that other door is outside of the swing. What I wanted to note with this too is that it's not always completely straight through. I mean, that door could be moved over a little to the side. When we talk about, they're not always exactly parallel, but if you have a limited space that someone has to pass through, there's no place else to go to get from point A to point B straight through there, then we would look at it more as doors in a series and require that there be that 48-inch separation. Okay? And now I have gotten you, I've told you everything you need to know about alterations, and I'm sure you'll let me know if I didn't tell you everything that you need to know about alterations. I got you from your bus stop, from your cars, to your accessible entrance. And now Paul is going to successfully enable you to maneuver around in that space.
Thanks, Arlene. I don't know about the successful part, but let's work on the interior. Slide 33. When people talk about access, they many times automatically think of the ADA standards. As many of you know, when it comes to ADA, there are other requirements outside of the standard in the Department of Justice regulations one has to be aware of. This is particularly important because within the retail spaces, there could be a lot of fixtures that are furniture. And as you know, the ADA standards does not address access for furniture. Yet, because the ADA is a civil rights law and the ADA regulations from the Department of Justice address non-construction issues, even with furniture there's an access issue. The problem is the regulations are general in nature and specifics, unlike the standards, aren't provided. So it can be difficult to answer questions about what is the minimum. In the picture you have there on slide 33 is a gift shop. The architecturally that space could be accessible. Basically it's a square space. You know, you have your moving clearance at the door, relatively easy to construct. But then the tenant brings in a lot of furniture, and then questions arise, what is the minimum access requirement? Do I have to have this carousel for postcards on an accessible route, et cetera? We can't answer that question. If you have questions about how the ADA applies to furniture in the retail establishment, you need to go to the Department of Justice and get their guidance as it relates to application of their regulations. We will, as we're going through this presentation, try and answer things as if everything was fixed, subject to the standards. We say furniture is something, when you turn the building upside down, it falls out. Now, the slide immediately starts about Americans with Disability Act, and Arlene pointed out the same presentation applies to Architectural Barriers Act. Now, in this area, there are no Architectural Barriers Act regulations for maintaining accessible features or even coming close to addressing furniture. That would probably be more addressed by the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is a separate training, complicated training. If you got a question about that, call our technical assistance line. Slide 34. For the most part, we're going to be focusing on areas open to customers, but we did have a question related to areas that are exempt, employee work areas. Now, as many of you know, in both the Barriers Act and the Disabilities Act, Section 203 or F203 contains some general exceptions for access. Most of those spaces are probably not in the retail environment or in the areas open to customers, so we're not even getting to them. But there's one provision that would come into play, not for customers, but for employees. Section 203.9, which talks about employee work areas. So if none of the other general exceptions apply, an employer could use this, or a designer could use this, to say an area did not need to have the same level of access expected as for a customer space. Now, I should point out a mistake in the slide. Section 203.9, of course, exists in the Disabilities Act standard, but there's no similar provision in the Architecture Bears Act standard. So in your PowerPoint, strike F203.9. If you looked in the Bears Act standard, that section addresses residential. So in facilities subject to the Bears Act, unless one of those other general exceptions in F203.9 applies, you need to make the space accessible as if it almost was open to customers. Now for the Disabilities Act, we will go look at Section 203.9. And the first question is, of course, what is an employee work area? You have to start with the definition. You know, all or any portion of a space used only by employees, used only for work. Corridors, toilet rooms, kitchenettes, and break rooms are not employee work areas. Slide 35. Here's an example of a sales space. Obviously, a customer area in the very front. You come through some doors, maybe off of a shopping mall corridor, and then in the back you have a loading dock, stock room, an office, and those are all marked in yellow to say they would be potentially areas used only by employees to do their work. At the bottom right-hand side of the stock room, there's a toilet room. So even if that toilet room was used only by employees, it would not be eligible for that work area exemption, because it's not used by employees to do their work. Now in blue, we're showing dressing and fitting rooms. Not all of them have to be accessible, but we will talk about that later. So if a area is used only by employees as a work area, and you're using that exception in 203.9, at a bare minimum, you need a punch, enter, and exit. Now yes, that exception does have sort of like an exception within it that talks about spaces raised, less than 3 inches square feet and elevated 7 inches above the finished floor, where that elevation is essential to the function of the space. For our purposes of this webinar, we're assuming that situation doesn't exist in the retail realm. So you're left with the requirement that at the minimum, a work area needs approach, enter, and exit. And I'll explain that part a little bit further. Second, if a work area is more than 1,000 square feet or more, all circulation paths have to meet accessible route requirements. Plus, for a work area, if an accessible means of escape, accessible means of egress runs through the space, then it needs to run through the space, and that path that's part of the accessible means of egress would have to be conforming. Lastly, a work area would need wiring to support the installation of visual alarms if this facility as a whole would have needed strobes as part of the fire alarm system. So in our example here, if the stock room was under 1,000 square feet, you would have the accessible route running past the dressing fitting rooms and entering the stock room, and then further access would not be required until a need arose from an employment standpoint. In this particular example, we don't have any accessible means of egress running through the space, and obviously we don't show any wiring for visual alarms. But everything else in the space used by employees to do their work would not be subject to access requirements. So you could have fixed work surfaces in there. Well, it's inside the work area, would not have to meet the access requirements. You could have controls and operating mechanisms that would not have to meet the access requirements. Next slide. Now, actually, I just realized, in terms of, I didn't have the slide for approach, enter, and exit, which would be essentially the accessible route that leads somebody up to the door. And then you have enough space on the other side basically to hold a wheelchair, which is about 30 by 48. And no other space would be needed for maneuvering. So you could say somebody approaches, enters, and once enters, backs out of the space. Okay, slide 36 we're on shows the interior accessible route running past some features, and the question is what aisles need to be accessible. But before we get that, we go to slide 37, and the question is when do I need an elevator? When do I need to provide the vertical access? And Arlene mentioned a little bit of this, that in the ADA there are some vertical access exceptions for buildings, privately owned buildings. There are less than three stories, or each story is less than 3,000 square feet, provided it's not a shopping center, shopping mall, or office of a healthcare provider. So if you have a two-story building that's part of a shopping mall, you can't get out of vertical access. Now, in this particular picture, you have a one-story building with a mezzanine, and under the standard, vertical access is not required. Yet, on that mezzanine, there are various customer service features that are important in terms of providing access to persons with disability to goods and services. To what degree the operator of this facility needs to provide some type of accommodation, and what that accommodation would be to enable individuals with mobility impairments to be able to get to the mezzanine or have access to the goods on the mezzanine, even though vertical access is not required, you best consult the Department of Justice because it's not addressed in the standard. Slide 38. For the most part, when we're dealing with then the accessible route, you know, we're talking about what we call the walking surface with running slopes of less than of 1 in 20 or less. In the retail environment, we're pretty much talking about a near level surface. So what are the clearances then, since slope is really not an issue in most circumstances? The minimum width as shown in the figure would be 36 inches, but can go down to a choke point that's 32 inches in width, provided that choke point is no more than 24 inches in length. And if you have a series of choke points, you need at least space 48 inches by 36 between the choke points. Now, when we come to clearances, and actually slide 39 is where we've raised, the question was raised, what about going around various features in the shopping center or floor fixtures? How much clearance do I need around them? And if you look at this figure here, it shows that when you have to make a 180-degree turn around an object, you may need additional space, either as part of the width or as part of the depth. So if your width is 42 inches minimum and you have 48 inches in depth, you can make that 180-degree turn. But if you have a 60-inch depth, your width would be 36, as we explained earlier. Now, what about if this obstruction you're going around is a grocery store? You know, that's where the self-service shelving is located. Does my grocery store width have to be wider? Slide 40. So here's a picture of a retail establishment, a department store, where you have a U-shaped, well, we've colored in accessible route. Yet, there are other aisles shown, and the question was, to what degree do these other aisles have to meet accessible route requirements? And we're working on the assumption, even though most of this is furniture, for purposes of our analysis, we'll just assume that it's all fixed. If we look at the scoping sections in 225, it says at least one of each type of storage facility has to be accessible. Now, the advisory section indicates that a type is closet, cabinet, shelves, clothes rods, hooks, and doors. So clearly, it's possible that there are many of the same type in here, and the scoping says at least one of each type will be connected by an accessible route. So we have a table, we have a clothing rod, and we have some other things that are falling in that advisory note of one of each type. So therefore, you would have the accessible route to it, and we'll see later It has to be within the accessible reach range. But you say, well, what about the rest of this stuff? Now, we have the requirement that all self-service shelving be on an accessible route, but the reach range requirements don't apply. Looking at the picture here, very little of this is self-service shelving. So does that mean they're not required to be connected by an accessible route, these clothing racks? And per the standard, one could say no. But this, again, because this is furniture, for the most part, you need to check with the Department of Justice what it means for these aisles. So if I was looking at the picture and just applying the minimum requirements, the part shaded would be the minimum accessible route, possibly, and the minimum width would be 36 inches. Now you may say, and because we're not making a 180 return around an obstruction that's less than 48 inches wide. Slide 41. But yet, what about the grocery store? Does that mean if I got four aisles, let's say it's a very small little grocery store, can I have 36 inches and not have a 60-inch depth? And the answer is yes. This is actually in a webinar we had done earlier when we were talking about libraries. We said, yes, if you can come down and make that turn, for example, if you come down aisle number one and make your 90-degree turn and then go down aisle number four and make a 90-degree turn to then be able to go down aisle number two, you're not required to have either an increased width in the aisle or an increased depth of 60 inches, as shown in the left-hand figure. However, not shown in the right-hand figure is you would still need space at the bottom because you, at some point, have to make a 180-degree turn around, in this case, the object that's less than 48 inches wide. So going from aisle 4 to aisle 3 would somehow, at some point, would need to be done. So even though it's not shown at the top of this figure, at some point at the bottom. Now this could be a major cross aisle, this could be space at the service counter, but you would need it at least at one end. Next slide. Slide 42 is trying to deal with the issue about queue lines. What's the minimum width? I was in a, I think it was a Wendy's restaurant, and it was a fixed queue line. So you apply that earlier turnaround obstructions. And in the Wendy's example, I was making a 180-degree turn around the center rail. And therefore, I would need additional space, either as part of the width or as part of the depth. Now, how do you measure that, particularly if you're getting into well, the requirement is a clear width. If there's some sort of support for the post that's holding the rails, in this case I have a picture of a cord running between two posts, you need to look at the change in level for the post support. If it's more than a half inch beveled or more than a quarter inch vertical, then it can't count toward the width requirement. But if that post is going straight into the ground like a fixed post, then you'd measure along that path, do I have the clear width requirements as shown in section 403. Slide 42. Where do I need turning spaces? I may create a consulting room at a pharmacy, a little space. Does that mean in that space I need a turning space? Well, in the standard, pretty much only a few spaces are directly required to have turning spaces. Toilet and bathing, and dressing and fitting. There's one or two spaces I can't really think of. But there's no blanket requirement that every space have a turning space. Although it may be useful for purposes of usability, it may also be useful and recommended for purposes of meeting your general non-discrimination requirements. But there's nothing in a direct requirement that for, say, a consulting room in a pharmacy area that it be equipped with a turning space. The door to it, of course, would have to meet maneuvering clearance requirements as discussed by Arlene earlier. Slide 44, please. Okay, now we're going into shelving and displays. A little bit we've already talked to before, but here it's more of the reach range issues. Slide 45. If we look at the scoping in section 225, and I made reference to this earlier, at least one of each type has to be accessible. And for lockers, 5% of each type have to be accessible. And by accessible, it has to be on an accessible route and within the reach ranges. The difference is the self-service shelving. It doesn't have to, it has to be on an accessible route, but the reach range requirements do not apply. So it's permissible for this self-service shelving to have shelves way outside of the reach range. For the one of each type that has to be accessible and within the reach range, that means others of the same type can be out of the reach range in terms of just meeting the requirements of the standard. And as I said earlier, how Department of Justice general obligations for access and their regulations would come into play as it relates to products available on the shelf, those are questions you would have to talk to the Department of Justice about. But let's go to slide 46. If it has to be accessible, it has to fall within a reach range. For a side reach, whether it's a side reach or a forward reach, the maximum would be 48 and the minimum would be 15. But we'll see later in other slides how the maximum will drop depending on whether you're reaching over an obstruction. And for a shelf that had to be accessible, we would say, can you reach to the edge? This isn't necessarily reaching in to it, it's reaching to the edge. Slide 47 shows an example of self-service shelving, which would be required to be on an accessible route. And if a shelf there would have to meet one of the shelves, would, in this example, would have to meet the one of each type requirement, so obviously at least one of the shelves are within the reach range. In this case, it's more than one shelf. Slide 48. Protruding objects. Particularly with furniture, and I think this is what the caller was talking about, but the question is, when do the protruding object requirements apply? We can see in the far left example, it provides protection for persons with visual impairments. And in the center, we're talking about a figure that shows basically the requirement projection from the side or an overhead clearance. But what do you do when you come to a piece of furniture and the clothing that's on it? And how do the protruding object requirements apply to it? Again, we're going to be answering as if it was fixed furniture. Slide 49. But before we get to the furniture, some parts are obviously very much subject to the architectural requirements. In the picture there, we have a set of stairs where the underside would be a protruding object. Operationally, they solved it by putting in planters. Thereby, they would alert somebody before they got into the protruding part. But still the question remains, protruding objects apply to projections into circulation paths. What is a circulation path? Next slide, please. Even though I provided the definition and the intended purpose, this is a tough one to answer. We have that question all the time. Is this square in the corner part of a circulation path and thereby subject to protruding object requirements? And it can be debated. You know, somebody asked a question about a toilet room. Is every single square inch of that toilet room part of a circulation path? The best I can say is first start with the definition. An exterior and interior way of passage. I know one person in our staff keys upon way of passage. So there's some square inches on the floor that would not be part of a way of passage. Second, I think it's also important to look at the intent. The intent is to provide safety for persons with visual impairment, or nowadays, I guess, also safety for people using their smartphone and looking at their text messages and not looking up. You know, what can I walk into that might bump me in the head or smack my side shoulder, et cetera. So maybe from that perspective, you know, can somebody walk into this and therefore is it wise I apply the protruding object requirements? And that's probably a good thing to do. But how would this then apply to maybe fixtures that we would have in a retail establishment, page 51? You know, we have a lot of objects to project out, but the first question is, you know, what is their leading edge? In this example, it's a lot of coats and pants. And could somebody go as far as saying, and this is Department of Justice realm, you know, do I measure the protruding object for the coat hanger sticking out or the post on which the coat hanger is hanging? Well, we do have post requirements. Projections into circulations from a post, and you could see it's a maximum of 12 inches. You know, can I approach straight on? You know, will I run into the horizontal pole before I hit, you know, will I run into that before I sense it with my cane? In the figure to the far left, I have three arrows. It's interesting how they solved the problem. In the green arrow, it's pointing to a clothes rack, but there's a display before it. So if somebody makes a parallel approach to the clothes rack, they'll run into the sense the display first before they, you know, they'd make a parallel approach to the clothes rack, so it's not a projection. Now the center arrow shows an object, another clothes rack, where it's possible you can approach it from one of the side aisles. So therefore, it could be considered a protruding object, at least the rack itself. Now, in this case, you're running into pants, so you'd probably sense the pants before you went any further. But if that was after a major sale and all the clothing had been sold off, it may be a consideration. And then the third example is, again, you would be able to approach it straight on. But some people say that is not projecting into a way of passage. Slide 52. What about protruding objects in queue lines? Again, worst case scenario, if this is fixed and the top rail, the top is above 27 inches, you would need per the standard a warning that is at 27 inches or below. Now, when it's portable in nature, or portable where you have ropes or chains connected them, it probably doesn't hurt to follow the principles in the standard, but to what degree would apply from a mandatory perspective, you need to talk to the Department of Justice. Slide 53, sales and service. Slide 54, we got a picture of a grocery store. We're going to look at the checkout aisle and the sales and service counter. So in this example, we have five checkout aisles and one service counter. So slide 55, when we talk about checkout aisles, and somebody remind me, I need to speed up, thank you. We have scoping that tells you the number of checkout aisles have to be accessible for each function. So if I had five checkout aisles and they all have the same function, two of the five would have to meet the access requirements. Slide 56. We do have an exception for alteration of where the selling space is under 5,000 square feet, no more than one checkout aisle has to be accessible. We also have an exception for alterations where the alteration of checkout aisles would create an impact, you can go down to one accessible checkout aisle, but look at that exception. Slide 57, we're going to look at the technical provisions of the checkout aisle. So we'll go to slide 58, and we have the checkout aisle. The maximum height would be 38 inches, but you could have an edge edit that's an additional 2 inches maximum. But if you provide a check writing surface, the standard says that check writing surface would be no higher than 34 inches and no less than 28. So in this particular figure, the center one, we have the checkout aisle from the standard and added to it is the check writing surface. Now sometimes merchants have electronic keypads for customers to sign transactions or swipe their credit card. If this is located on top of the check writing surface, that's not a problem, because in our guide to the standards, which is on our website, we say if you make a side reach and you're reaching over an obstruction, the obstruction cannot be any higher than 34 inches. If the obstruction is higher than 34 inches, technically per the guide, you can't reach over any amount. So it's in the case of where the card swipe is above the check writing surface and it's no higher than 34, you could reach over a maximum of 10 inches and the maximum height would be 48 inches. But to go to slide 59, if I'm reaching over an obstruction that of course is no higher than 34 inches and the depth is more than 10 inches, my maximum height drops down to 46 inches. Now in the picture here, we have a self-service checkout aisle, and the controls and operating mechanisms of that would have to meet the requirements of 309, like the reach range provision we just talked about. And the self-service checkout aisle would be a type of checkout aisle. Slide 60. The width of the checkout aisle that had to be accessible would be a minimum of 36 inches. Slide 61. We're also going to talk about scoping for sales and service counters. At least one of each type has to be accessible. So going to slide 62, the technical provisions for an accessible service counter would be a maximum height of 36 inches for either a parallel approach or forward approach. Slide 63. We do give you an exception when you're altering your sales and service counters where the impact of would cause a reduction in the number of existing, I'll owe you an answer to that one, but I need to move on. I can't find my notes in my write-up. Bottom line is there is an exception in the standard when you're altering existing service counters and the reduction would produce an impact. We will clarify that when we get to the question and answer time. Service counter depth. You could say, I have a service counter, and the question arises, well, is the entire part required to be accessible, or can I have an employee part and a customer part? And we would say yes. In the example there, A is the customer part, and the higher part might be the employee part, and that's okay. Now, as long as all the service counters have the same depth, then A is okay. But if A was one size and that was the accessible one and all the others were the example of B, so the non-accessible ones had a little bit more space, that would be a problem. Now C shows the entire thing at the same depth, and obviously that either is okay both for the employee and the customer or for the entire customer. So if you can break the counter down into an employee part and a customer part, you can apply the accessible 36 height to the customer's part, but make sure that that customer service counter is the same as the other customer service counters in terms of employee space. Minimum service counter width would be 36 inches. The Department of Justice's 2009 document about maintaining accessible features in retail establishments indicates there can be no merchandise and equipment on that accessible portion. Next slide. Slide 65, I just talked about. So slide 66. Sales and service counters may be equipped with some sort of glazing There is a communication write-in requirement in the standard, and you can see in the picture three service counters with a way of communicating. Slide 67. Food service lines. All food service lines have to be accessible. If a tray slide is provided, the maximum height would be 34 inches, the minimum would be 28. Slide 68. On a food service line, at least 50% of each type of self-service shelving must be within accessible reach range. So you can see there in the picture, depending on how far you have to reach, the height of the shelf would either be 48 inches maximum or 46. Now remember, the tray slide can be no higher than 34, so it's okay to reach over that obstruction. Now we would say that 100% of the self-service shelving has to be on an accessible route, as mentioned earlier. Slide 69. All dispensing devices for tableware, dishware, condiments, food and beverages must be within an accessible reach range. Must admit, we sort of discussed this here with some other colleagues here in the office. Some people were saying that you apply the controls and operating mechanisms requirements, which does end up with almost, well, virtually all controls and operating mechanisms be within the reach range. Slide 70, there was some debate about in terms of reaching, you know, the paper dispenser or where you have the trays stacked in terms of the reach range requirements, but that's probably then a good interaction between the standard and the operational requirements, more coming from the Department of Justice regulations. But clearly, any control and operating mechanism that one would have to reach to, like the soda display, soda dispensers, or the ketchup pump, you know, has to be within the reach range. Slide 71. Dining surfaces are subject to the standard 5%, a straight 5% of the standing or seating spaces for dining have to be accessible. There isn't any 5% of each type, unlike some earlier requirements, a straight 5%, but you're required to disperse the dining surfaces throughout the dining area. In this particular example, we have 10 tables, so you would need two wheelchair spaces that are accessible at two of the tables. If you had 11 tables with four seats each, you would need three because you always round up. Going to slide 72, the technical specs for the dining surface, of course you would have the knee and toe clearance, a minimum of 17 inches deep. The height of the surface would be 28 to 34 inches, and the width would be 30 inches minimum. You know, your 30 by 48 minimum clear space at the table. Slide 73. Dressing and fitting rooms are in there, and we're going back to that picture you saw earlier when we were talking about employee work areas. It requires at least 5% of each type of use in each cluster to be accessible. I would say that if you have only one, that one has to be accessible. If it's in a cluster, 5% of each type. In this example, we're assuming they're all nine are the same type. So therefore, one of those would have to meet the access requirements I'm going to be talking about. Now, if hooks, coat hooks and shelves are provided in other dressing rooms, you need to provide them in the accessible dressing room at the proper reach range. Next slide, 74. The accessible dressing room. The door cannot swing into the space unless you have a 30 by 40 space outside the swing of the door. The dressing and fitting room is required to have a turning space. Slide 75. Within the dressing room, there has to be a bench. I would like to call this a dressing bench or changing bench, because it's not really intended for sitting. Some people grab, they're building a bunch of benches at a park, and they see the word, the title for section 903, and they apply it to every bench out there. If you look at the dimensions, it's 20 to 24 inches deep. So if you had to sit on a 24-inch deep seat, it would be quite uncomfortable to lean back and have your legs hang over the side. But in this dressing bench, the depth, of course, is 20 to 24 inches and a minimum width of 42 inches. And you can see in the picture you have the 30 by 48 spaced along the side that allows a parallel transfer. Okay, slide 76. The bench will have back support, and you can see the back support will extend to a height of 18 inches above the seat. The gap at the bottom will be 2 inches maximum. You don't need the gap, but that's where you would have, if you wanted a gap, 2 inches maximum. Slide 77. ATMs and fare machines are addressed. You know, we talk about one of each type, and Arlene briefly talked about one of the ATM requirements that we had a question on. I'm sorry, at least one of each type at each location has to meet the access requirements. Slide 78, vending machines. A lot of vending machines would be considered furniture, but if built in, clearly would be subject to the standard access to one of each type within the reach range. So this Coca-Cola machine, if built in, you need to make sure those controls were no higher than 48 inches. You can see in the picture a 48 by 30 space that allows a parallel approach to the Coke machine. Slide 79. Now, we had a few other questions before we get to your questions. Somebody asked us about the toilet and bathing room exception number 4. It talked about no more than 50% of single-use toilet rooms in each use at each cluster shall be accessible. And their question, what is meant by each use? And we'd be saying something like use would be like men, women, children, unisex. That's what we had in mind. So those are our questions. I want to make one other clarity to what I had said earlier. When I was talking about the elevator exception, less than three stories, less than 3,000 square feet, that's the exception that private entities under Title III can use. Title II entities, state and local governments, as well as federal government under the Architecture Barriers Act, cannot use those exceptions that I made mention too. All three entities do have that one-story mezzanine exception in their standards. So going to questions now. Peggy?
Okay, thank you, Paul. And Arlene, so we're going to move on to some questions now. People have been submitting them in the chat room throughout the presentation. First question, can you give an example of a location for a drinking fountain where it would not be required to be on an accessible route? So that was a question for you, Arlene.
Well, what I mentioned earlier is that if you have a drinking fountain that's located in one of the areas that have a general exception, they're not required to be on an accessible route. I'll give you an example of that, but let me also clarify that only 50% of the drinking fountains are required to be accessible. So if you have, you have to have at least two. There's a requirement for a high and a low. Once you've met that minimum requirement for at least two, then in addition to that, if you have additional 50% of those are required to be accessible. And if you have beyond that and you've met the 50% and you have other drinking fountains that are not required to be accessible, then those drinking fountains are not required to be on an accessible route. But in addition to that, say there's a general exception that talks about construction sites. And it says that anything that's used specifically for those construction workers are not required to be accessible, not required to be on an accessible route. So if you have a drinking fountain put in that area that's for use by those construction workers, that's not required to be accessible, therefore not required to be on an accessible route.
Okay. There was another question about, is there a minimum distance from a wheel stop to a curb to prevent vehicles from encroaching on the walkway?
The ADA does not specify a distance between the wheel stop and the curb. That may be something that's specified in your local codes when they're telling you how to construct parking. Basically, we give you the width of the space, we tell you the length of the space, and now if that wheel stop is actually there and that prohibits the length of the space, the only thing that we would have that coincides with that is when we talk about the access aisle, as I have said, and that access aisle needs to extend the full length of that parking space it serves. But the ADA does not mandate a distance between the wheel stop and the curb.
Okay. Another question relating to parking dispersion. If you only have two stalls provided, can they be placed together or do they need to be separated?
The spaces can be placed together. The way the parking works is you can look at all of the parking facilities that you have on the site and add up the parking spaces to get the number of accessible spaces that you're required to have. Once you do that, what we want is a dispersion so that you have some on the closest accessible route to the closest accessible entrance. If you have multiple entrances, it's very important to disperse those. If you're talking about a smaller entity, you only have the two spaces, then just ensure that where you're locating those spaces is on the closest accessible route to the accessible entrance, and they can be grouped together, because if one is on that closest route, then that would mean the second would be two, and that's what our goal is there, to have those spaces so that they are the closest spaces on the accessible route to the closest accessible entrance.
Okay, one final one for you, Orlene, and then we're going to put Paul on the spot next. So I guess they were just asking for some clarification about the accessible drop-off areas in a lot that are used exclusively for delivery. So
yes.
Kind of expand on that.
Yes, I talked about that a little earlier. Basically what there is there's an exception. Because overall with parking, we say that all parking facilities are required to be accessible, and there's a certain number of spaces within the lot that are required to be accessible. But in addition to that, there's an exception that says that if you have a lot and that the only vehicles that are in this lot are your impound vehicles, your delivery truck vehicles, that lot is not required to be accessible. What I may have said that made it a little unclear to you is that if that lot is something that's going to be accessed by the public, say you have an impound lot, and people are coming in to get their cars that have been impounded, and they actually would have to access that lot. What we're saying is that the only way that lot would not be required to be accessible is if you have a compliant passenger loading zone someplace on the facility. Then that car can be brought to that person, and they could access their car at that passenger loading zone. But if there is no public access in these areas, then there's not a requirement for that accessible passenger loading zone.
Okay. Moving on to Paul. Let's put him in the hot seat here. This person wanted to know how the exception at 904.4.1 for counters, how do you apply that when the counter is less than 36 inches? 4.1.
Right. I mean, it's to me, the exception is dealing where you have a counter that might be only 24 inches long. It's saying you're not required to make the counter 36 inches long if it's only 24. But if I have a 5 foot long counter, then I need to have a part of it 36 inches long that is no higher than 36. However, if I only have a 24 inch long counter, then the entire counter will be no higher than 36 inches.
Okay. So
Another question came in when you were discussing employee work areas, and I guess both of you talked about them, but this was a question about whether or not a walk-in cooler would be considered a work area.
Well, potentially a walk-in cooler could be an area zoned by employees as a work area, I think, in most circumstances. In most circumstances, it would be, but often this is out of a space like in a kitchen, which is a work area. And I would assume that if the walk-in freezer plus the kitchen were together under 1,000 square feet, all you would need is approach, enter, and exit to the kitchen, further access in the kitchen and into the walk-in freezer would not be required.
Okay. So on another topic, this person was asking about where you have a checkout aisle and you have digital pads. You were talking about the height of the checkout aisle surface, writing surface, and this person was asking about what about credit cards where you have to sign a digital pad. Is it subject to the, is it 28 to 34 inches in height? What would be the requirement?
Good question. I would say call the Department of Justice on that. It's not a check writing surface. I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah, there, just to add on to that, just in terms of point of sale machines, there's in the future expected to be some rulemaking related to those elements that will probably address more specifically this issue. So yeah, I think the best option at this point is to contact the Department of Justice to get some further guidance from them on this issue. Okay, so is there a requirement at dining surfaces that wheelchair, where you have, I guess, two wheelchair spaces, do they need to be side by side, such as at a bar counter?
Well, probably an example used in the presentation where there were 10 tables, I mean, per the black and white of the standard, there's a dispersal requirement. So I would say those two have to be dispersed. Now, whether the Department of Justice would say, no, if you only have two, they can be side by side, you talk to the Department of Justice. Now, in bigger spaces where you have many tables and many accessible dining work surfaces, you know, that's probably okay to have some of them grouped together in groups of two, provided you have a broad dispersal condition.
Okay. I'm looking through our list here. There's one here about parking. Basically, can designated accessible parking that is above the minimum ratio, I'm assuming they've met the minimum with the number of accessible parking spaces required to comply. If those designated accessible parking is 100 yards away from an accessible entrance, when available parking on an accessible route is 15 yards away. I'm not sure that we quite understand the question here, but if it's related to any parking that you provide, accessible parking that you provide above the minimum required, of course we would encourage you to put that on an accessible route, but there may be circumstances where you can't, you know, that would not be required since you've met your minimum and you have connected those minimum spaces by an accessible route. Okay. Paul, you had another question?
Yeah.
Or you wanted to clarify your citation?
Yeah, well, I was talking about sales and service counters. I had a slide that talked about a smaller surface of 24 inches when you're doing alterations, and I'd lost my notes, but now I can find them. That's when you're doing alterations to your existing counters, and the end result, to make it fully accessible, would produce a reduction in the number of existing counters at workstations, then the exception allows you to have a 24-inch long counter instead of 36-inch long. And the 30 by 48 would be centered on that 24-inch portion of the counter. So that, I wanted to bring that up.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Paul. And Erlene mentioned this earlier, but if you have some questions that we did answer a fair amount of the questions that were submitted and the ones that came in advance, but if you didn't get answers to your questions, please feel free to call the board. Our 800 number is listed here, 800-872-2253 or TTY 800-993-2822. TTY, you can also email questions to ta@access-board.gov and we can, any of the accessibility specialists that are on the line can try to answer your questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robin. And
this is just a slide to give the information for continuing education for those of you that are seeking your AIA or other credits for participation today. Again, once we have verified your participation in today's session, your accounts will be updated with your available certificates. Those of you that asked for us to report your credits for your certifying body, we will submit those credits on your behalf and your records will be updated so that you will have that information available to you. So again, thank everyone for your participation in today's session. You were given the information to contact the Access Board if you had further questions. Our next session next month is on accessible emergency transportable housing and it will be held on December 4th of 2014. If you're interested in attending, please register at accessibilityonline.org. We will be taking questions in advance for that session, so please make sure you submit your questions. Their questions are due 2 weeks prior to the scheduled session, so we do have a deadline and we do take a maximum number of questions. So if you have questions, it's best to go in early. It's open right now for questions at this time, and those questions are used for helping the presenters to develop their presentation and target specific areas of interest to the audience, so we encourage you to do that. So this ends our session for today. At this time, you may just disconnect your computer by closing the browser and or using the file drop-down menu to exit in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. Again, thank you everyone for your participation.